In light of yesterday's government and court closure, today the court will hear the cases set for hearing on 21 March and those set for today in the following modified sequence. Burris first, followed by Berry in the morning, Armstrong followed by Kelly in the afternoon. The court thanks counsel for all cases for their flexibility and responsiveness to these changes. And the first case is United States versus Burris. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey and members of the court. I'm Zachary Spillman. Major Ben Accinelli and I represent the appellant, Major Burris. Chief Judge Stuckey, may I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. You granted review to determine whether the Army Court was right when it held that under RCM 905E and RCM 919C, the mere failure of appellant's defense counsel to object to improper character evidence and improper argument waived any error. The Army Court's decision contravened a quarter century of this court's precedent. The Army Court's decision failed to consider the factors supporting application of stare decisis. The Army Court's decision conflicted with then impending, now finalized, rulemaking action by the President, clarifying that this court's precedent is right and forfeiture applies.
Well, counsel, what's the existing rule say?
The current rule, Your Honor, uses the word waiver, but means forfeiture.
Oh. It says black, but it means white.
Well, Chief Judge...
Well, I do not deny that this court has muddied these waters over the years. But it seems to me that perhaps a recension to first principles, i.e., what it says means what it says, might be in order regardless of muddying those waters. What do you say to that?
What I say to that, Chief Judge, is that it's not just this court. It's all American courts. It's all of American jurisprudence.
I'm not responsible for any court but this court.
Well, of course, Your Honor, but when the rule was written, the word waiver was often used to mean forfeiture. However, the word forfeiture is never used to mean waiver. I was thumbing through the manual for courts martial the other day, just as some pleasure reading, and I noticed that the word forfeiture, the word forfeit, as a noun, is used only twice within the Red Book, within the 2016 edition for the Manual for Courts Martial. It's found in RCM 804C2 in the discussion, where it addresses forfeiting the right to be present by not showing up for your trial. And it's in Appendix 21 in the analysis of RCM 912F2, addressing forfeiting the right to make a peremptory challenge. Every other instance of the word forfeit or forfeiture in the Manual for Courts Martial is a reference to forfeiture of pay and allowances. It's a verb. And so the rules for courts martial, the rules of evidence, simply do not use the word forfeiture. They use the word waiver. And over and over again, the word
waiver means, so what's that indicate other than a lot of courts ignoring what the rules say? Are you saying that it changed meaning over time?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that the word waiver in RCM 905E and RCM 919C means and always has meant forfeiture. And that's clear from the context of the rule, from the analogous federal rules from which it's drawn, and this court's precedent. This court did not accidentally find that the rules meant forfeiture 25 years ago.
No, this court for decades had an attitude of, shall we say, looseness toward the rules because the sentiment was that the troop shouldn't suffer because A, his counsel screwed up, B, there was a nasty old rule out there that called for something we didn't want to do, etc., etc., etc. But we've moved away from that in the last 20 or so years. So are you saying we go back to it? Or, you know, admittedly, this is a blip in time because the rule's about to be changed again, and I'm not going to comment on that. But Isn't this a hangover from the days of paternalism when this court just blew off things like time limits and so forth because we didn't want the troop to suffer?
I have three answers for you, Chief Judge Stuckey. The first is no, it's not paternalism. The decisions, Difoot and the other decisions, this court's precedent did not say that these were rules of forfeiture for paternalistic reasons. You said that these are rules of forfeiture under normal statutory construction reasons. The court differentiated between active waiver and passive waiver, which is the same thing that the federal rules have done. The federal rules that are analogous to these rules don't use the word waiver anymore, but they did at the time, and that's a recognition of the fact that the word waiver has meaning and is not the meaning that was originally intended. The second, I think the second answer to your question, Chief Judge, is that the shelf life matters. There is a long-standing precedent.
The shelf life of what?
Shelf life of an opinion that this court might issue in this case, finding waiver. The president amended the rule, changing the language to forfeiture, eliminating any ambiguity in this, effective on January 1st of next year. That's 200 and some odd days from now. Frozen food has a longer shelf life than that, Your Honor. If this court were to upset 25 years of precedent without any of the considerations of stare decisis, without considering the fact that nobody asks this court, the appellee, the United States government, does not defend the Army Court's decision. The Navy Marine Corps Court has explicitly rejected the Army Court's reasoning. Even the Army Court doubts its own reasoning. There is no reason to disturb stare decisis and the precedent of this court and say suddenly that because the rule uses the word waiver, it means actual waiver. The last piece, Your Honor, is that at trial, the parties understood this court's precedent. The parties and the military judge are presumed to know the law, and the law is forfeiture. And so what we have here is a decision from the Army Corps.
The parties are presumed to know the law.
Well, I think so,
the judge is presumed to know the law. If the parties knew the law, what are we here for?
Well, because sometimes they make mistakes.
Okay.
And sometimes there are error, right? And an accused has the right to be tried, and if he's convicted in a proceeding that is free of prejudicial error. So the parties knew that forfeiture applied. They were not under a sort of Damocles requirement to make an objection at the time.
Well, counsel, nobody relies on the distinction between forfeiture and waiver. I mean, because if you forfeit something, you only get plain error review.
So that's right, Your Honor. The failure to object at trial forfeits the error. So we've got our continuum between preserved error, unpreserved error, and waived error, or no error. So there is a penalty for failing to object. If a trial defense counsel deliberately fails to object, there are other considerations that come in. But what matters here is that the Army Court retroactively changed the rule. And they did so without a request from anyone. I mean, all of the parties, we and the Government Appellate Division, agreed before the Army Court in the briefs that forfeiture and plain error applies. The Army Court heard oral argument in this case. I argued this case. Nobody asked about the waiver rule. There was no specified issue. There was no request for briefing. We moved for reconsideration and asked for the opportunity to brief this issue. And I would have written the very same brief I wrote for this court. We were denied that. The retroactive application of the rule is the problem. If this court were to say that waiver in 905E and 919C means actual waiver, then we would say it should be a prospective rule only. Because it's not fair to change the rules after the game is played.
Mr. Spillman, in your view, why did our opinion in Ahern cause consternation and confusion on the part of the CCA here?
Your Honor, I can't speculate to the CCA's motives, but I can say that the court didn't ask for briefs. Had they asked for briefs, we would have distinguished Ahern the same way we did in our briefs here. It's easy for anyone to come to a decision without the debate and the presentation. And so, you know, we don't blame them for reaching what we think is the wrong decision, but we do believe it's the wrong decision. And we think Ahern is very much distinguishable, not just because of the rule at issue, but because of the way the decision was reached.
Counsel, assuming, arguendo, that plain error applies, where's the plain error? This beast business came from the appellant. He was under no compulsion to voice it, to inform the government about it or anything else. He elected to. It's on the table. He opened the door. Where's the plain error?
Chief Judge Stuckey, we don't agree that it came from the appellant, and we don't agree about this beast thing. First, in terms of coming from the appellant, Major Burris spoke with CID. He spoke to them for about an hour and 45 minutes. And during that interrogation, which is recorded, which is in the record, which is referenced in the joint appendix, he does use the words, the beast. And then he says, it's a joke. Over and over and over again, he says, it's a joke. I counted 8 times in about 2 minutes of the interrogation. He described this joke in the context of consensual sexual encounters in grad school. And he was trying to address the statements made by his then-estranged, now ex-wife, in their custody and divorce battles. Now, Major Burris at the time, this is 2014, I believe, Major Burris was an active-duty Army judge advocate. He was the chief of justice. He had been accused of sexual offenses by his wife who had left him. He was terrified. And he had every reason to be terrified because of what he was accused of in the climate in which he was accused. And if you watch that video, you'll see this is an officer who is absolutely terrified for himself. And so he is trying to address everything all at once. He is speaking as fast as he can. And he talks about the beast as a joke. Now, that beast thing, the thing that was done at trial was introducing the beast during opening statements as, quote, the alter ego that sexually assaults the alleged victim time and time again. That's Joint Appendix at 186. Trial counsel also said to the members that Major Burris uses privacy as a shield, hiding the true Major Burris, the Major Burris his family has to endure for years from the rest of the world. We're going to slowly chip away at that shield. We're going to uncover who the accused truly is. What they sought to uncover was the beast. The alleged victim testified, this is Joint Appendix at 365, that the beast is this complete different person, this evil, angry animal that comes at you. It doesn't have any empathy for you at all, just attacks you and is non-responsive. And trial counsel brought it all home in closing argument, arguing what does a beast do? Does a beast listen? Does a beast talk? Does a beast want your opinion, your insight on what's happening? No. A beast takes. A beast doesn't reason and it doesn't care. It was a perfect name because that's exactly what the alleged victim described to you from this stand in this courtroom. That's Joint Appendix at 556. Chief Judge Stuckey, the prosecution's case against Major Burris was weak. It consisted primarily of the uncorroborated, inconsistent, inherently unbelievable claims of his estranged wife who was fighting him for custody of their children. The prosecution knew that it had a weak case, but it also realized something else. Beasts belong in cages.
Mr. Spillman, in regard to the plain error review that the Chief Judge was just raising, you seem to be in your brief saying this ought to be, if we find that forfeiture is the correct approach, it ought to be remanded unless you're going to find in favor of my client, and then you should dispose of it. Do you have a more neutral approach to this? Do you think that remand is appropriate under any circumstance? Or
Judge Olson, we acknowledge that that's a heads we win, tails they lose approach. The reality is that there are two issues here. The first is whether or not there was plain and prejudicial error that affected the findings. Well, I mean, that's the definition of prejudicial, but that requires the findings and sentence be set aside. The second is whether the beast, the prosecution's use of the beast, affected what findings and sentence should be approved. The CCA explicitly held that it sees no reason to look beyond appellant's clear waiver. Since there's no waiver, it should have looked beyond. And the issue here is that if nothing else, in sentencing, the prosecution requested a sentence of confinement for 16 years. The members adjudged 20. So there's an effect. There's at least the appearance of the effect, and that's something that only a court of criminal appeals can consider. The issue of whether or not this court should look at the plain error, whether or not you should reverse for the plain error, seeing that my time has expired, is something that I will address, Chief Judge, if you'd like me to now, or I'll take on rebuttal.
You can take it on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Natanya Gans, and I, along with my co-counsel, Major Cormac M. Smith, represent the United States. The way the government used appellant's own statements about the beast was fair and proper comment on the evidence. And this is true whether this court applies waiver or forfeiture.
What's the United States' position as to which should be applied?
In this case, Your Honor, waiver should be applied because of defense counsel's intentional relinquishment of his right to object.
But what is the government's position as to what the general rule should be, not the rule in this case? Should it be forfeiture for failure to object or waiver?
Your Honor, the United States' position is that the mere failure to object to evidence coming in and to improper argument is analyzed by this court under forfeiture. However, in this case, defense counsel intentionally relinquished his right to object. And he did this first.
Is it your position then that the assigned issue was phrased in a way that is confusing or not right on point here? Your position in response to Judge Ryan is it seems as if your answer is in complete agreement with the government in terms of how 905E should be interpreted in terms of either forfeiture or waiver.
Your Honor, yes, for the most part. The United States does see how ACCA came to the conclusion they came to in their interpretation of Ahern.
But your position then, the government's position, is that Pavlone is what governs this particular case, not Ahern, which was looking at a different rule.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so when Ahern talked about that this was not a case where the word waiver is used but actually means forfeiture, that this is a case where waiver is used but they mean forfeiture.
Yes, Your Honor, based on the principles of stare decisis.
So there's no dispute then between the parties as to what the answer is to the granted issue. You take issue, the difference is whether it was, in fact, plain error in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. To the granted issue, yes, there is no dispute. However,
then why are we here?
Why are we here? Are you, no. Is the government's position this is forfeiture?
Your Honor, the government's position is that in response to the specified issue, the answer is forfeiture. However, in this case, which this court can consider, there are definite indicators of defense counsel's deliberate decision.
Okay, but the CCA applied waiver, not in terms of this particular case, but as a blanket rule. So
yes,
why should this court not simply remand back to the CCA to analyze this?
Although this court could, Your Honor, for reasons of judicial economy, we ask that you do dispose of it now.
I guess it comes down to whose judicial economy.
Yes, Your Honor. There is indication, there is language in ACCA's opinion about how they lean on the question of plain error. They talk about the beast evidence as not even being character.
But why wouldn't we just summarily reverse them, say you got it wrong, that the rule is not waiver, it's forfeiture, do it over?
Your Honor, you could do that.
I know we could. Why shouldn't we?
Because
you'd like to have an answer now.
Yes, Your Honor. If this court would like to go into other components of this case, I'm happy to do that.
Well, I'd be interested to know why you think it's not plain error.
Yes, Your Honor.
Since the fundamental issue appears to have just collapsed.
Yes, Your Honor. Evidence of the beast in this case came from one source, appellant. These were statements he made the morning after he raped his wife, when confronted with the rape.
But he's not the person that argued on behalf of the United States government, is he?
No, Your Honor.
So he's not the person that made the statements during the course of the argument that the appellant that is complaining about, right? I mean, the knowledge of the term came from the appellant, but the use of the term did not, did it? The first person that used it was whom?
The first person to use it was the government in opening argument. However, the first party to introduce the evidence, to elicit this evidence from a witness, was in fact defense counsel. When he cross-examined a government witness early on in the trial, he was a staff judge advocate of the 82nd Airborne Division. He cross-examined that witness and asked that witness, has Major Burris ever told you about the beast before? The witness said yes, prior to trial. And this was important to defense counsel's case, because then defense counsel, in closing argument, was able to argue that Major Burris is the forthcoming one, the honest one, the credible one, and juxtapose that with WB, who defense counsel argued was not credible, was a liar, took something that happened in reality and embellished it to an outlandish extreme. And this goes as well to the CID interview, in which Major Burris himself, about 44 minutes into the interview, started talking about the beast. And he not only started talking about his interpretation of the beast, he started talking about what he believed WB's interpretation to be. And he verified that this beast, this character, does in fact exist. And the explanation he provided was dubious at best. He said the beast is about a woman rubbing up and against you in the middle of the night. And then you start to wake up and start to kiss on and cuddle with that person.
So all those issues could be resolved by the CCA in determining whether there was an affirmative waiver, right?
Yes, Your Honor. However, that also shows that it was not, that none of this was error. These were appellant's own statements. And the way the government used
Did the CCA, is this a belt and suspenders deal? The CCA says, well, it's waived. But if it's not waived, we got suspenders, and it's not plain error.
Your Honor, they unfortunately did not go even into that.
They didn't go to the okay.
Analysis.
Well, then.
Did they go into affirmative waiver, or they just said it's as a matter of law, it's waived?
Your Honor, they did not go into affirmative waiver either.
Okay. Go ahead.
Counsel, if trial counsel had referred to an accused as the beast, both in opening statement and closing argument, and that wasn't a nickname that had been used, would you agree that that would be plain error, that in general, trial counsel cannot refer to the accused as a beast?
Yes, potentially, Your Honor. As this court has noted in United States v. Haney, when the language has a tendency to be inflammatory and is not based on facts and evidence in the record, then yes, it is improper. However, here it was based on facts and evidence in the record. And if you actually look at what the trial counsel said following this court's guidance in United States v. Bear, that you cannot surgically carve out portions of an argument into words in isolation, but you must look at the context of the argument and the context of the entire case when determining error. Here, trial counsel was commenting on specific occasions in which Major Burris raped his wife. And he linked that. She linked that. Trial counsel did not say, these are the characteristics of a beast, X, Y, Z. Major Burris has a name, the beast. Therefore, it's more likely that he raped his wife. What trial counsel said was, Major Burris did these horrible things to his wife. that is characteristic of what a beast would do, therefore the nickname is a good name. And that's permissible argument and inference on the evidence of record.
Counsel, would you comment on the appellant's argument that, on the appellant's Rice Krispies shelf life argument, basically, they have now explicitly, the government, the president has now explicitly changed the rule. It comes into effect 1 January. Even if we admit that we have muddied these waters for years, so we have one moment of purity and then it goes back to something else, only this time at the behest of the president. What's the point?
Your Honor, to get the point would be to decide this case accurately.
Well, but you've already given us a less intrusive way to decide the case. That seems to be the government's position now.
Your Honor, the government's position is that despite this court's precedent on the mere failure to object, this is not a case in which defense counsel merely failed to object. And I know I keep saying this, but if you actually look at defense counsel's actions throughout the pretrial and the entire trial, it's...
Okay, what you're saying, I think, is that even under our muddy precedents, this isn't forfeiture.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Because if this court looks at... If this court takes United States v. Campos and United States v. Ahern together... United States v. Campos was looking at a rule of evidence, just as in this case, in terms of the beast evidence coming in and defense counsel not objecting. And then, in United States v. Ahern, we have a rule of evidence that defense did not object to, and then it was argued in closing argument. The exact same thing happened here. Throughout the trial and pretrial proceedings, this evidence was out there, and defense counsel had advance notice of it from 10 July 2013 when Major Burris made his interview with CID. That's about a year and a half until the first day of trial, 5 January 2015. And on Joint Appendix 20, this court can see that this case was referred on 7 February 2014. So that's when the motions window opens. And from then until the first day of trial on 5 January 2015, there's almost a year, 342 days in which defense counsel could have filed any number of motions to limit, suppress, or preclude this evidence in some way.
If it's not proper evidence, why did they need to do that?
Your Honor, if it is proper evidence, why would they?
I said if it's not proper evidence, if the government isn't allowed to go around calling people a beast, right, just because they hear that someone is called, giving him that nickname, it would generally be improper for the government to stress that or emphasize that in their opening or in their closing, why is the onus on the appellant to file a motion in limine?
Your Honor, I disagree.
We all know what a motion in limine is.
Yes, Your Honor. I disagree with you that it is improper for the government to do that.
If it were improper, I'm not asking you to concede that it is, but if it were improper, why is the onus on the defendant to file a motion to keep the government from doing something that it shouldn't do anyway?
Your Honor, I wouldn't say that the onus is on the defendant to file a motion, but that is just one factor in the inquiry, whether or not they did file motions. Defense counsel also affirmatively stated no objection, Your Honor, when the government sought to introduce this evidence.
That all goes to whether there was an affirmative waiver.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, not to whether they should have done it, they being the government.
Yes, Your Honor. The government, if this was improper evidence, the government should not use it. And if it was 404B evidence, you would expect the government would file notice, but it wasn't. There was no notice filed. It wasn't improper evidence to begin with. So the government didn't have any obligation to file any motions, any notice, anything like that. I would just like to use a couple minutes just to talk about the prejudice.
Before you get, and I want to hear about prejudice, but I just want to make sure I know what the government's position is.
Yes, Your Honor.
The government's position, I think, is that despite, if a rule says waiver, waivers, silence, inaction is not enough, regardless, which is what we seem to say in a lot of these decisions. Is that the government's position?
No, Your Honor, not for...
Does the government concede that?
No, Your Honor, not as a blanket statement, for example.
Is that with respect to this particular rule?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Based on
this... No, I'm not talking about, you know, the rules at stake here.
Yes. The rules at stake here, not...
Okay, the government says that mere silence isn't enough to constitute waiver.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. You please discuss prejudice.
So there was no error in this case, and it also wasn't clear or obvious, as this court has noted in United States v. Short, when both military judge and defense counsel failed to recognize this perceived error as error, and the military judge fails to see any need for a remedial measure, it's a difficult burden for appellant to show that this was clear or obvious error. And then in terms of prejudice, the government prevails on all of the Fletcher factors. First, the severity of the misconduct. Here, where trial counsel talked about the beast was one paragraph in a 20-page closing argument. Moreover, she went on to give another 8 pages of rebuttal in which she did not mention the beast at all. There were no curative instructions given, again, because nothing was objected to, but the military judge did give his standard evidentiary instruction about closing arguments not being evidence. And then finally, the weight of the conviction. This was a strong government case. WB testified for over 130 pages on direct and gave clear, detailed, accurate descriptions of the times Major Burris raped her. Additionally, WB's mother was an eyewitness for one of the Article 128 assaults consummated by battery. Dr. Pugliese testified at trial that Major Burris in a counseling session told him that he had, out of a need to control his wife and calm her down, grabbed her by the arms and put her in a chair. Major Burris in his CID interview vehemently said over and over and over, "No, I have never put my hands on my wife." Additionally, this court's analysis in United States v. Sewell and United States v. Pablona can further reassure this court that the jury came to their decision independent of any purported improper argument or evidence. The jury went back to their deliberation with 18 specifications. They acquitted Major Burris of 10 of them. And then if looking within the Article 120 charge, there's 4 specifications. All of those are specifications in which the beast would apply. The panel convicted him of 2 and acquitted him of 2. And then further, in one of the ones they convicted him of, they actually crossed out diverse occasions, crossed out the government's time range, and then put their own exact date when the evidence had bore out that this happened. The members' precision with this can show the panel that the panel engaged in a careful, deliberative process based on the evidence alone and made an independent assessment of appellant's guilt or innocence with regard to each separate specification. Pending further questions, the government asks that this court affirm the holding of the lower court for the reasons aforementioned.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. We are here, Chief Judge Stuckey, because the beast is an improper propensity-based theme, and such improper themes are a recurring problem in cases reviewed by this court in recent years, whether it's the improper use of charged offenses for propensity purposes as in Hills, whether it's characterization of an accused as, quote, an old dirty man in the trench coat, as was done in Sewell, or as, quote, a criminal infection that is a plague in the Marine Corps, as was done in Hornbeck, or whether it's an appeal to the members to think what we know, common sense, ways of the world about child molesters, as in Frey, propensity appears over and over and over again as an improper substitute for actual evidence of guilt.
As I recall the record in this case, and correct me if I'm wrong, I almost called you by your first name. That's why I had to hold Mr. Spillman. At the end of the argument, I recall an issue arising between the military judge and counsel. And defense counsel, although they had not objected, did express their concern about the reference, possible reference to the accused's silence. Do you remember that part?
I do, Your Honor.
All right, now, I also remember that what happened was they all talked about it. They took a recess. They went back and had an 802 conference. And during the 802 conference, according to the record, they listened to the trial counsel's argument. Did they not?
They did, Your Honor.
And when they came back on the record for the subsequent 39A session, counsel and the military judge seemed to have resolved the issue. But the focus appeared only to be in reference to the accused, or to the reference or potential reference to the accused's lack of or his right to silence. And I think it had to do with some phraseology in the trial counsel's argument that who hasn't come in here and told you X, Y, and Z. Do you remember that part?
It was, Your Honor. It was sort of a vague reference to the fact that Major Burris had not testified in his own defense.
Right. Now, the only reason why I raise that is that it would seem that if trial defense counsel were as concerned about, or was as concerned about, the reference to the beast, wouldn't that have been the most logical point to raise that issue?
Perhaps, Your Honor. I mean, I would hope.
I mean, if they were as concerned about it as you are, and if it was as obvious that it was this impermissible, defense counsel having chosen to talk to the judge about this other concern, it suggests, at least on the record, does it not, that maybe this wasn't a real concern for the trial defense counsel?
Well, it suggests, Your Honor, that they didn't see it. They didn't realize what was happening. And that's really the purpose of plain error review, is that...
Well, I'm not arguing about whether it was what the standard is, forfeiture or waiver, or maybe I am. But my point is that I guess I don't understand if this was such a substantial infringement on the accused's rights. Why wouldn't defense counsel, who seemed to be pretty much on the ball with reference to this other issue, why wouldn't he? I mean, the beast was a theme throughout the trial. You yourself said so.
It was, Your Honor, and we can't know why they didn't see it. We just know that they didn't see it. And in particular, we know that they did not affirmatively waive it for a number of reasons, and I address them in our reply brief. For one, we don't believe that the right to be convicted based only on the evidence and not based on character is waivable at all.
No, I understand that.
But more fundamentally, the defense never adopted the prosecution theme. They never embraced it. They addressed the beast in totally different contexts the few times they did.
Right. I guess my point goes to the issue of prejudice. And the question might be, by one observing the record, how prejudicial could it have been if defense counsel sat through the trial, heard all these references to the beast, heard the argument, raised a separate issue after the argument, got that one resolved, and did nothing or chose to, and then I guess on his own argument, he actually referenced the beast, did he not?
And I see that my time is about to expire, Chief.
Please answer the question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, you see what my concern is.
I see what your concern is, Your Honor. The answer to your question is that the prosecution theme, the propensity basis and how encompassing it was, doesn't become clear until you look at the record in its entirety. That at the time, as they sat there in trial, they simply didn't see it happening. But we can see it now. And because it's an improper propensity-based theme, and because it affected the findings, it's plain error. it prejudiced appellant and the findings and sentence should be set aside.
Okay, so your view is that it could still have had an effect on the members, even though defense counsel might have been asleep at the switch. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. We think, well, so there's two ways to look at that. Who has the burden to show the harm or absence of harm? But however you apply that burden.
Well, under plain error, don't you have it?
Under plain error, if we have the burden to show it's not harmless, right, that's to say that we have to show some indication of an effect.
So how is any of that before us? How is any of that encompassed within the issue that we granted, which basically is a binary choice, right? Which is correct, forfeiture or waiver, with respect to these rules? Isn't that the issue that we granted?
It is, Judge Ryan. It's not in the granted issue. It is absolutely outside of the granted issue.
Do you agree that at least one appropriate course of action would be for us to answer the granted issue in light of the fact that the parties agree what the answer is and send it back to the CCA to do a new Article 66 review?
Not really, Judge Ryan. We believe that you have to do that anyway because they haven't done the 66 review and that's unique. But we also think that it matters that Major Burris requested speedy appellate review.
Given that they have to do it anyway, right? Given that they have to do it anyway, why not make them do everything?
They right? don't have to do it if you reverse, Your Honor.
But it's not what you're asking us to do in order to reverse and reverse completely requires us to decide an issue that we did not grant.
This is true.
Thanks.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. The court is in recess until 10:25.
Court stands in recess until 10:25.